time anyways.
How you doing? I was just saying your name. You must have heard me.
Was your ears burning?
I'll just take it. It's
a likely excuse. Did you pass it?
I got no idea.
Well, I hope you did. I have faith in you.
I could always whip out the old Matthew.
Yeah, Chris!
Actually, I haven't seen... I haven't seen him. I was going to say, I saw him a couple of weeks ago. He cracks me up.
You cannot say anything wrong about someone who's just always happy. He's pleasant.
Yeah. And if I could bottle his energy, oh, I would be so rich. Oh, I know. Yeah.
It's so crazy.
Oh, from prior to college?
Yeah. Oh, he's like that.
Yeah, he's always been like that. He's just been like that ever since I knew him. And it was just so wild. He showed up first day and it's like, oh, you're here too.
Oh, nice. Nice. You know, I had him in, I think, three of my classes. He actually had two of my classes at the same time. And he crushed everything. It was just, like, awesome. And he didn't necessarily get the best grades, but because I have so much extra credit, that's all he did was extra credit. His averages ended up being, like, the highest of both classes that semester. I mean, it was 130 or something like that. It was just incredible. But that was the way to do it. All right, Sussex Pledge. Sussex. You know what that's all about?
The Germans thinking that the Sussex, which was a French ship, was a minesweeper, shot a torpedo at it. SM UB-29, commanded by Herbert Puskuchten. Let's say this right, Puskuchten. But as we saw the picture, it didn't sink. It just blew the nose off of it. But there were Americans on board, and they were injured. So, Wilson goes before Congress and basically condemns the action. And in response to what the U.S. president said, Germany issued what is known as the Sussex Pledge, in which they promised to abandon U-boats tactics, to the extent that they were doing. If they saw passenger ships, they would leave them alone. If they saw merchant ships, they would rise to the surface and search them, just like the British were doing. And they would only sink them if the ship was basically full of war materials. British military vessels, French military vessels, firing on sight. But don't forget, the catch of the Sussex Pledge is that they would only change their tactics if the U.S. made the British stop their violations of international law. Meaning, the expansion of contraband, the visits and searches, which became visits and seizes, and of course, blockading neutral ports. All of that had to stop. But of course, Wilson heard Germany say they were going to stop and ignored the, oh, America's going to do something part, which was very convenient. Now, that's not to say that he didn't try bringing an end to the war, because he did. He was convinced 100% that the best way for the United States to avoid being dragged in was to end the war before the U.S. could be dragged in. He would send over his personal advisor twice to Europe, Colonel Edward M. House. Now, here's the funny thing. Woodrow Wilson was a Southern Democrat. The colonel was also from the South. But like Colonel Sanders, who makes delicious chicken, Colonel Sanders never served a day in the military. Because you know what wealthy people in the South were rewarded with? Military recognition. So the colonel, I mean, it wasn't even an honorary position, that's just what he was known as. But the other thing was he actually wasn't even a government official. He wasn't an ambassador. He didn't work for the State Department.
He was just a personal friend. So, he would send House over as his agent, and he would actually go around twice, and he would meet with the different governments of the belligerents, basically trying to figure out what do they want to end the war. But amazingly, in his reports back, sorry, I thought there was another click, but I guess not. I'll talk about that in a second. In House's reports back to the president, he discovered that none of the nations actually want to end the war. They actually don't have any terms that they're fighting for. Because by 1915, 1916, all of the governments believe that if they pull out of the war, they would be victims of revolutions. That the people would rise up and overthrow the governments out of animosity for losing the war. I mean, after all, you're in it for 2.5 years and then suddenly you're just going to quit and get nothing. So how do you end a war that the belligerents don't want to end? So when that didn't work, Wilson basically carefully started pushing for what became known as a preparedness campaign. Slowly, he began taking steps to begin preparing the nation to go to war. Now, the problem was the United States military, even in 1916, was pathetic. They still had rifles largely that were built, you know, a decade and a half before. They didn't have massive stockpiles of munitions. They didn't have a standing army. Their navy was kind of So they weren't really ready to go. So he began convincing Congress to start basically planting the seeds. In June 1916, Congress adopted proposals to increase the size of the Army and the Navy and the Merchant Marine. He also convinced Congress to push for the founding ROTC programs at any university that received federal funding. Because he knew he needed soldiers and he needed officers. He also began working with some of the big, powerful industrialists to plan how to basically mobilize the economy at a moment's notice. But the challenging part was 1916. What happens every 4 years in America? Yeah, this presidential election year. So the president was running for re-election. Now, here's the amazing thing. The vast majority of the people, like we said, wanted neutrality. And they were okay with the hypocrisy that we talked about last class. They were okay with being neutral but making lots of money by sending guns and bullets over to Europe. But it was in the 20s, low 20s, percentage of Americans who thought us getting in was a good idea. So he couldn't campaign on we're going to go to war because that would cause him to lose the election. But at the same time, he couldn't be a pacifist because one of the most influential popular people in America, former President Theodore Roosevelt, had been calling for the United States to enter the war since it began. So, Wilson in the White House had to deal with Roosevelt parading around America, calling for Americans to get into the war. Now, here's the irony. Because of Roosevelt, Wilson won in 1912. Because Wilson split the Republican vote with Taft. Had Roosevelt not ran as a progressive, either he or Taft would have easily beat Wilson. And with a Republican president, I've seen many historians who've argued that World War I might not have happened. Because guess who was fishing buddies with the King of England, the Kaiser, the Tsar of Russia? Teddy Roosevelt. And guess who he was not going to help once the war started? The Republican was not going to help the Democrat. But it was not Roosevelt who was running. No, no, no. In 1916, Roosevelt started having health issues because in 1912, there was actually an assassination attempt on his life. He famously got shot in the chest at point blank range. What are you smiling about?
It's just a funny story.
Do you know what happened to him?
Yeah, he kept giving a speech after he got shot.
But why didn't he die?
His
speech was 99 pages long, and he had it in his jacket. And it had, if he didn't happen to have his speech, he would have been dead. So he gets shot, the bullet actually goes through the pages, does enter his body, but as he's sitting there bleeding, he gets up on the stage for an hour and a half and gives the whole damn speech. He was a tough hombre, to say the least. But 1916, he bowed out. He didn't have the energy to serve a term. And as it turned out, I think he ended up dying in 1918, so he wouldn't have made it anyways. So he tapped his good friend, Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Charles Evan Hughes, to run on the Republican side. He was a strong candidate. I mean, literally, he's the only Chief Justice in the history of the United States while serving as Chief Justice, ran for political office. He was an intellectual, he was a gifted speaker, and most importantly, he had the full support of Roosevelt. But Hughes made a huge mistake. He decided to play it safe. His advisors believe there's no way Wilson's going to win. Everybody hates Wilson. And so he made the mistake that Republicans often throughout history have made the mistake doing. Instead of tackling the hard issues, he tried having it both ways. So, simultaneous, he said, well, maybe we might want to consider going for war, but peace is definitely a better avenue. But maybe we should be ready for war, but then that would take effort and we don't want to make sacrifices because we love peace. He just talked randomly in circles. And even though he had the intellectual capacity, he had the support of one of the most popular men alive, he failed to excite voters. But at the same time, Wilson is going out on the campaign trail and he's able to pound his chest and saying, look, I got Germany to stop using U-boat strikes. They agreed to the Sussex Pledge. That's because of me. And that's what's going to keep us out of the war.
But it was close.
It was close. In fact, it was the second closest election in the history of these United States. One state decided the outcome. California. Wilson won California. I think the exact total's up there.
No, that I can't read the... It's a little more than 3,000.
So because Wilson got those 3,000 or so votes, he was able to get enough electoral votes in the college to win by the narrowest of margins. 277 to 254. Had Hughes won California, history of our country would be very different. Does anyone know which presidential race was the closest? Nope.
No. Or was it Bill and Gore? Because of Florida, or am I?
Yeah. Not Bill and Gore. Al Gore and George Bush. Yeah, because of Florida.
Yeah.
537 votes determined that election. So if you ever hear people say, go vote, your vote does count.
But whether you win by a vote or a million votes, a win is a win is a win. And by the way, look at what he ran on. This was his pledge to the American people. I'm going to keep you out of the war. But re-energized, renewed, within hours of the election being determined, Wilson again went back to work, trying to focus on keeping the country out of the war by ending the war. He believed that now we're into 1917, that the Europeans might be willing to sit down for mediation. Let's sit down and talk, and let's see if we can figure out what you want. He would send notes, diplomatic notes, to all the belligerents, basically telling them to state anything you want to bring about peace. But unfortunately, nothing came of it, because kind of like how the world views Joe Biden, Germany and England and France and Russia and Austria, they're engaged in a battle of survival. Do you think they really care what America says? So not a single country responded to him. If at first you don't succeed, try again.
So when he couldn't win it through overt diplomacy, he decided to take a page out of Teddy Roosevelt's book. He would take advantage of the fact that he was the president of the United States, and he would use what Teddy Roosevelt referred to as the bully pulpit. When the president speaks, the press listens. The world press. So he decided to go before the nation, to invite the world press in, and to send a message. In January 1917, he would declare in a speech before Congress what would become known as his 14 points. The 14 points was Wilson's vision for the post-World War. The key to the 14 points
is that he wanted to achieve a peace without victory. As he said, and I quote, "There must be not a balance of power, but a community of power. Not organized rivalries, but an organized common peace. It must be a peace without victory. A victory would mean peace forced upon the loser. A victor's terms upon the vanquished. It would be accepted in humiliation and duress, at an intolerable sacrifice. It would leave a sting, a resentment, a bitter memory upon which the terms of peace would rest. Not permanently, but only as if upon quicksand." If you beat somebody and make them surrender, they're going to hate you. They're going to want revenge. See what happens after the end of World War I that would give rise to World War II. So what Wilson was basically saying is, look, no one is responsible for this war. Because everyone's responsible for this war. So let's just stop killing and let's act like adults. And let's see if we can cooperate and bring about real peace. The key themes of the 14 points are straightforward. Self-determination. He said that every people should be able to determine their own fate. Freedom of the seas, i.e. free trade. Instead of killing one another, we should all do business with one another. Because there's only one color that matters, green. And we should hammer our guns into plows. There should not be nations during peacetime with standing armies like the size of Russia's before the beginning of the war. Well, 1.5 million men under arms. If you're going to have an army that big, it only serves one purpose. So there should be a general demilitarization. Now, here's the funny thing. He claimed that he was speaking, and I quote, "for the silent mass of mankind everywhere." In other words, he wasn't speaking as the President of the United States. He was speaking for the world community. And to ensure peace, he also laid out the formulation of a grand forum where all nations could gather together and solve problems through diplomacy. He called it a League of Nations. We'll talk about the specifics of the League of Nations later. But long story short, he argued simply that if Chris and I have beef, and he's on his phone sending texts and tweets to his buddies, and then I get on my phone and I send texts and tweets to my buddies, and we're pissed off at each other, our buddies are probably going to be like, take a swing at him. Take him out. He's a chump. But if Chris and I would sit down at a table and look at each other eye to eye, chances are neither of us are going to raise a fist in anger because we'll end up talking, because that's what human beings do. Well,
most Americans were okay with this idea.
Why? Because we're not going to get involved in the war. And look at our president. He's telling the world how to behave.
Look at him,
waving his baton like a conductor. He knows what's best for everybody.
How do you think the Germans felt? Or the British? Or the Austrians, the Hungarians, the Russians, the Italians, the Turks, the Japs? Think they gave a rat's ass?
Actually, truth be told,
all across Europe, particularly the Allies, who the United States had been doing business with, viewed Wilson's statement as a withdrawal of support. Or, potentially even worse, that they were going to switch sides and somehow start supporting the Central Powers. And by the way, as we're going to see, 1917 was a good year for Germany. And there are dozens and dozens and dozens of primary sources printed in England and in France and in Russia that strongly imply that Germany is on the verge of winning the war. So, to the Allies, when they hear Woodrow Wilson saying, oh, we're going to have this peace without victory, la da 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 da, they're sitting back thinking, he's jumping on the bandwagon. He hated the Celtics his whole life until the Celtics were on the verge of winning a championship. And then suddenly he's bleeding green. But in the midst of this,
the pendulum suddenly went off the rails.
At the same time, Wilson is articulating his plans for peace. Four things happened. Back to back to back to back. That ultimately would change the dynamic here in America. The first occurred on January 11th, 1917. A fire would break out in a munitions plant owned by a Canadian company located in Lynnhurst, New Jersey. Kingsland was a factory town. Anyone know what I mean by that term? But who owns the town?
Well, until around this time, it's just named the companies themselves that own it.
Yeah, yeah. So the company owns the town. The residents in the town work for the company, and part of their wages is housing. But the company also owns, like, the grocery stores, the schools, the parks, and everything else. So this Canadian company came down, bought a huge plot of land in New Jersey, built a factory, built a whole bunch of houses, and basically employed the town making bullets for England. Now here's the catch. Because it was a Canadian-owned company, technically when they put their product on ships to sail it across, there's a loophole. It's not American-made. Even though it was made in America, it wasn't American-made. Even though technically it was made by American citizens. But January 11th, a fire broke out. And when Building 30 went up, give or take 500,000 76 millimeter high explosive artillery rounds detonated, blowing up the entire plant.
the damage radius was 2 miles. Where everything in that 2 mile radius, obviously the closest you get to the center, was either leveled, seriously destroyed, or at least charred. But imagine an explosion big enough to destroy things in a 2 mile radius. It's a big boom. Well, the fire alarms went off. Fortunately, when the fire started, before things blew up, and amazingly, all 1,400 workers escaped unharmed. It was a miracle. But up until 1931, it was believed it was an act of German sabotage. It wasn't until 1931 when one of the factory workers confessed on his deathbed that he accidentally had a bunch of rags that had chemicals on it and he threw them in the trash. What are you laughing about?
Just don't do that.
Why not? Yeah, chemicals mixed with chemicals and you could get fire. But think of the news stories in 1917. An act of terrorism on American soil. Then, a month plus later, the newspapers again are expressing shock and horror when the Brits would intercept a coded message that was sent from German Foreign Minister Alfred von Zimmermann to the German ambassador in Mexico, Heinrich von Eckhardt. Zimmermann, Eckhardt. Now you can't see it because I couldn't find a very clear image, but the way to send messages was via telegraph lines, and one of the companies that was responsible for transmitting transatlantic messages was Western Union. And so this message does not contain words, but rather it's based on a numeric code. So this could be translated, even though it was picked up in England, but then Western Union was then to resend it to get to Germany. Well, unbeknownst to the Germans, the Brits had broke the German code. So they were able to decipher this message. Again, I like testing your knowledge. What was going on in America in 1913? Do you know?
Wasn't the Spanish-American War?
No.
Actually, wait, no. Didn't America send troops into Mexico?
Yeah. Why?
It was over some, outlaw or something like that, or some revolutionary?
Mexico experienced a revolution, and three of their military dictators were battling it out for control of the country, and one of them, Pancho Villa, had a big tendency to take his military forces and essentially march through Arizona, New Mexico, and basically loot and pilfer, and then go back into Mexican territory. Things got so bad that Wilson actually sent Navy vessels to Veracruz. I can't remember the other Mexican port. And there were Marines that were deployed, and there were shots fired, and people died. We were on the verge of going to a war with Mexico, which would have been our second Mexican-American war. It was only sheer luck that one of the winners in the Civil War, Carranza, managed to reach out to Wilson and kind of negotiated a ceasefire, in which Carranza basically told Wilson, look, you can do whatever you want to get Pancho Villa. The Mexican army isn't going to respond. So Blackjack Pershing led an American expeditionary force. I think they penetrated Mexico something like 100 miles. They never ended up catching them, but they caught a lot of Villa's supporters.
So we were on the verge of going to war.
Everybody in the world at the time knew that, too. So guess what Zimmerman instructed Eckhart to share with the Mexican government? Well, here's the deal. If Mexico preemptively engages in war with the United States, and by the way, Pershing had just pulled out of Mexico in February 1917. He had been kept going back in, and he was there for nearly 2 years trying to find Pancho Villa. So the Americans just left. So Germany wants Mexico to preemptively strike the United States. And in exchange, Germany promised to help Mexico recover what in the telegram described as her lost territory of New Mexico, Texas, Arizona, and California. All of the lands that Mexico lost when Texas went for independence and the subsequent Mexican-American War under the presidency of James Knox Polk. Well, Carranza actually assembled a commission in which they were to assess the feasibility of fighting a war with America and actually conquering and holding those territories, which were no longer full of Mexicans, but they were full of Americans. The commission concluded, one, it was not possible. The American military was equal in strength to the Mexican military at that time, but unlike Mexico, the United States has the Second Amendment. And the Mexican government correctly assessed that if a Mexican army penetrated Texas, Arizona, New Mexico, it would be the American residents who would be shooting at the Mexicans before the army could even get there. And two, they looked at the consequences of losing. Mexico should not have existed after the first Mexican-American War. The United States actually occupied the capital. They seized Mexico City. They achieved a complete, total surrender. The only thing that stopped the United States from conquering and absorbing Mexico was the fact, and you're going to laugh, that it was full of Mexicans. Mexicans were Catholics. In the 1840s, the overwhelming majority of Americans were Protestants. And guess what? The Protestants hated the Catholics. So James Knox Polk, in his calculations of basically giving almost all of Mexico back, minus the third that we took, was simply that we would have to deal with the Catholics and that would be too much of a problem. Plus, let's factor in the Missouri Compromise. 1848, America was still a slave-holding nation. And under the Missouri Compromise, every territory south of the southern border of Missouri would come in by right as a slave state. Look at a map of North America. Take the United States, add Mexico, think of all of that southern land that could be slave. It would have tipped the balance in the Senate and the House, and America would, in perpetuity, be a slave nation. So, James Knox Polk made the tough decision, instead of taking what America earned by right, to try to save us for the future. So, the Brits translated the communique and sent it to Wilson. and it was printed in the newspapers. And Wilson would use the Zimmerman telegram to convince Congress to use emergency measures to begin the mass production of maritime vessels, including the famous Armed Ship Bill, where Congress would authorize American vessels to begin arming merchant ships. Because America was getting closer and closer. And then just a week and a half later, a revolution erupts in Russia. On the streets of Petrograd, St. Petersburg. In a southern shocking move, factory workers walked off the job, entered into the bread lines, started engaging in fights, and then began marching along the streets of Russia in protest against the Tsar and his government. As we're going to see next week, the Tsar would deploy the army. Actually, we might see it today because I don't have much America left. The Tsar would deploy the army because the army's job, they had no place, was to shoot revolutionaries. But by 1917, the Russian soldiers had had enough with their brothers getting shot. So the army joined with the protesters, and whoop-de-doo, we have a revolution. In less than a week's time, the Tsar would abdicate. And suddenly, Russia was on the verge of dropping out of the war. And Germany was winning. Well, this definitely helped the propaganda claim against the Central Powers. Because now Wilson could start contending Russia is no longer a monarchy, but it's going to potentially become a democracy. And they're going to want to fight with the French democracy and the constitutional monarchy of England, which is basically a democracy. So Wilson began trumpeting the effort to get into a war to save democracy itself. And then the fourth domino fell. It snowed so much it had whiteout conditions. Just. Where's the exact date? Sussex Pledge, May 4th, 1916. So we're talking 10 months. Germany decides to resume unrestricted submarine warfare. Now, FYI, Germany didn't just jump in and do it. The German Navy began drafting plans back on December 22nd, when they submitted a plan to the Kaiser, basically begging the Kaiser to agree to the resumption of unrestricted warfare. Now, FYI, this was based on data. This wasn't just, oh, I think we should do it. German experts conducted a study suggesting that if you could sink enough merchant ships going to England, that because of the population of the English Isles, England would run out of food. And when the nation ran out of food, that would terrify the people who would demand peace. According to this German study, they estimated it would only take 6 months. Now here's where the gamble comes in.
The United States has no navy, really, of any size. The United States has no army of any size. It would take time for them to build up their military strength, and it would take more time for them to deploy, because they have to sail across a 3,000-mile wide ocean. So these German experts basically calculated that if they used an aggressive enough approach with the submarines, they could actually knock England out before the United States got in. And there was many who believed, but not all, that when the Americans saw what was happening to England, they would lose their taste and not want to get involved. And by the way, as we're going to see, this close, England would get down to 6 weeks of food at one point. Well, after contemplating it, after talking about it, after discussing it, one day before the Kingsland explosion, the Kaiser signed on to the decision to unleash submarine warfare. Why? Hindenburg came in and gave the Kaiser a very grim update. The West was bogged down. The Allied divisions in the West were at the point where they were outnumbering Germany. The Allies had 190 divisions. The Germans only had 150. They contended that if the Allies attempted another attack on the scale of a Verdun or a Somme, that it would be possible for them to actually punch through. Plus, the Navy, after Jutland, was bottled up. And finally, the British blockade was having an effect on food supplies in Germany. There were reports of isolated incidents of disease, of starvation, and death. Long story short, the German military command basically said to the Kaiser, "We got to go all in now." But he was still hesitant. That was until, as was reported, Hindenburg looked at the Kaiser in his eyes, man to man, and basically told him, "The war must be brought to an end by whatever means as soon as possible, Your Majesty." After 2 more weeks of contemplation, on July 31st, the Kaiser would sign an order in which unrestricted warfare would resume on February 1st. As of that date, Germany had 105 U-boats ready to go. There were 46 in Kiel, their major naval port. There were 23 in Flanders, in some of the Dutch ports or the Belgian ports. There were 10 subs in the Baltic. There were 23 in the Mediterranean. And 3 managed to get through the Dardanelles and were ported in Constantinople. Plus, as the Kaiser's report stated, 50 were under construction, 25 of which only needed a few more months before they were ready to go. So they were going all in.
Well, when the German ambassador received the report from the Kaiser, he would go to the White House, meet with the President of the United States, at which time the President was outraged. And in a dual move, he declared that he was officially severing relations with Germany. No more talking. And he began pulling American passports of anybody suspected to have ties with Germany. That, of course, was 2.5 weeks before the Zimmerman telegram. Now, truth be told, the U-boat campaign initially was tremendously successful. February and March, and each month, German U-boats sunk in total approximately 500,000 tons of shipping to the bottom of the ocean. By the end of March, that equaled 25% of all British naval vessels. In April, they sunk another 860,000 tons. And like I said, food supply got down to 6 weeks. During those 3 months, they only lost 9 U-boats. This was winning. But England had a global empire, and they were able to bring in more supplies than the Germans could sink. But here's the big thing. As story after story after story is printed in the newspapers, it is clear and became clearer for more and more Americans that, we're going to have to go to war. And by the way, the Kaiser isn't flipping Uncle Sam off. He's snapping his fingers in his face. The Huns do not care for neutral rights. The Huns do not care for international law. If the Allies lose, the United States economy is going to be crippled. And if the United States didn't go in now, the Allies definitely would lose. So, the war soon became a case of defending national honor. August 2nd, 1917. For the fourth time? Do we declare war against Mexico? I don't remember. I think we just attacked. I don't think that was a declaration. I know Madison declared war in 1812. I know Lincoln. No, Lincoln didn't declare war because the South, he used Sumner. No, he did have to file a declaration of war. I know McKinley did it for the Spanish-American War. Yeah, I think for the fourth time in U.S. history. I might be wrong, but I'm pretty sure. Fourth time in American history, the United States president sent a request for a declaration of war to Congress. And Congress would vote. In his declaration, the primary focus was submarine warfare. That was the primary justification. Wilson, in his request, labeled it as warfare against mankind. In his request, he repeated what he said in the 14 points. That this was a war of liberation of all peoples, including the German people, from the tyranny of the German imperial government. And it's up to the United States, it's up to America, to make the world safe for democracy. Now, FYI, the two big points in this, he argued, they're fighting not just to defend the rights of the neutrals, but rather they're defending the rights of all people. And the only exception that he made was he distinguished between the military masters of Germany and the civilians. That he was going against what he called Prussian militarism, not the people of Germany. Interestingly enough, when Congress took up the matter, the Senate voted first, and it was not unanimous. The Senate voted 82-6. For war. The House, 373-50. Ironically, one of the most famous votes against the war was Jeanette Rankin. She was the first woman elected to Congress. So the first female congresswoman voted against the war simply because she was a pacifist and she despised war at all costs. But I give her credit because she was still in Congress on December 8th, 1941, day after the Japs bombed Pearl Harbor. And she was the only vote against going to war against Japan. So at least she was consistent. FYI, the United States would, in December, issue a declaration of war against the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But we never issued a declaration of war against the Ottoman Empire. So we were going to war against the Germans and the Austrians, but not the Ottomans. Question. All right, one last little chunk, and then we'll call it a class. Because I have to go to Chickpea. All right. Now, truth be told, American mobilization was on a scale unseen in human history. No other nation on Earth up to 1917 had ever done anything on a scale that America was able to do. When the war began, the total military force was about 350,000 men. That includes officers, non-coms, soldiers, sailors, marines, etc. When war was declared, Wilson, however, anticipated that Americans would run to sign up, to enlist. But much to his frustration, only 73,000 men volunteered in the first 6 weeks after war was declared. Because the attitude was, why do I want to get in a boat and get shipped across the Atlantic Ocean and I could be killed by a torpedo, and even if I arrive, I gotta go fight in the trenches to help the French? Really? So, in response, he implemented the draft. He got Congress on May 18th to pass what became known as the Selective Service Act. By law, all men 21 to 30 were ordered to go to their post offices and sign up for the Selective Service. Under penalties of fines and possible arrest. FYI, by the end of 1917, 10 million men had registered. But by 1918, it was clear that would be not enough. So the draft age was lowered to 18, and the maximum age was increased to 45. Which reached the pool of potential draftees to 24 million. But here's the catch. Men were then placed in one of five categories. And the lots would be drawn based upon the category that you found yourself in. The top category were able-bodied men without dependents, preferably unmarried. They didn't want to leave widows with fatherless kids. Of that category, roughly 2.8 million men would be drafted. Now, here's the funny thing. In the Civil War, the first time the United States attempted a draft, there were actually riots that erupted. New York almost seceded and joined the Confederacy when Lincoln tried pushing the draft. The draft almost caused the Union to lose. So, recognizing this, among the exceptions where you did not have to be called were if you had kids. If you were a father with kids, you would not be forced to go overseas. You might have to go into the military, but you would be deployed locally and domestically. Also, if you worked with certain essential occupations, factory workers, high-skilled positions would not be drafted. They would be exempted. Scientists, chemists, engineers. And they gave opt-out provisions for people who had issues with the war on religious grounds. So if you, for instance, were as a Jehovah's Witness, you know, Jehovah's Witnesses are not allowed to take up arms for any reason. Well, you could be exempted from the war. But, interestingly enough, one would think that a universal draft would include all men. But another interesting exception was put into place. Because Woodrow Wilson was a racist. And he didn't want black men going and fighting for their country. So, black draftees came in at a proportionally lower rate than whites. And the blacks who were drafted, which only amounted to about 370,000 total, were forced to serve in segregated units. And in most instances, they were not deployed as frontline soldiers. See, Woodrow Wilson was a friend of them there guys who don white hoods. The war would be financed by two methods. First, half through taxation on wartime profits, as well as income taxes. FYI, during Wilson's presidency, the income tax was put into effect. prior to ratification of the 16th Amendment, there was no income tax. Because the Supreme Court in like 1897 or 6 declared the income tax to be unconstitutional. Because there's nothing in the Constitution that allows for the direct taxation of people. So that was amended in the 16th Amendment. So while the original tax rate set in 1913 was low, when the war broke out, the top rates skyrocketed from 15% in 1913 to 67% in 1917, all the way up to 77% by 1918. That doesn't include state taxes, doesn't include local taxes. Imagine if the government, the federal government alone, took 77 cents out of every dollar you earned. The other half was raised through bond drives. Liberty bonds were sold. Do you know what a bond is?
Isn't it basically you pay the government, you buy it, it's like a government IOU pretty much? And
yep.
The government promises to pay you back? Or am I getting it mixed?
No, you're right. But what do they promise to pay back?
It's what you pay plus like interest, right?
Yeah. Yeah, very good. So they would sell you a bond at different denominations, and the government basically promised if you held the bond for 7 years, you would accumulate, give or take, about 4% per year. So if you got a dollar bond, after year one, it would be, when you cashed it in, it would be worth $1.04. Year two, whatever 4% of $1.04 is, add that to the $1.04. Year three, so forth. So after the 7 years, it's possible that you could turn in your dollar bond and you might be able to get like $1.30 back. These Liberty Bonds was the best selling campaign almost in American history. They would make several issuances of the bonds, and all of the subscriptions continually sold out. They had government rallies, they made posters, they had parades, all aimed at stirring up patriotism. They brought the Boy Scouts out, they brought the Girl Scouts out, they hired famous actors and actresses. Imagine that, Hollywood loved America at that time, didn't hate it like the current Hollywood. Of course, the most famous actor at the time, Charlie Chaplin. It was huge. He actually made a movie called The Bond, where he basically indirectly implied that if you don't buy bonds, you're a traitor. And you should get on a boat and go back to your own country. 21.6 billion dollars was raised. Wilson would also create what became known as the Council of National Defense. This would be a separate council to oversee the war effort. It included 13 members, six of which were members of the cabinet. This council oversaw all of specific tasks related to the war effort. For example, there was a branch created called the Emergency Fleet Corporation. The job of that entity, controlled by the Council of National Defense, was to make more merchant ships. There was a Food Administration, ironically headed by future President Herbert Hoover, whose job it was is to basically seize control of food production and distribution in the United States and ration it, so that way the civilians and the soldiers would have adequate supplies. There would be the Fuel Administration. in which the government went and nationalized all coal mines, oil production plants, and again, engaged in similar rations. It was the Railroad Administration, where the United States government basically took over control of all the railroads in our country. There was the War Industries Board, which planned out production levels. They actually sent mandates to factories and told them what to produce and what quantities. They also squashed the unions to prevent strikes. President of the AFL, Samuel Gompers, was actually given a seat on the council. And Gompers convinced unions not to strike, regardless of the working conditions, because of the war. But when the war ended, he got for the unions an 8-hour workday. Little quid pro quo. And those people working initially benefited. Wages went up 20%. Historic gain. But the problem was, inflation was so high. Workers would actually lose by 1918 one-third of the buying power that they had in 1916. Kind of like what's happening in our country. Here with the shit show that's going on in California. They mandated fast food restaurants, $20 an hour wages. Several chains have already started pulling out of California. All the prices have gone up and they're engaged in layoffs. Pizza Hut fired all of their delivery staff. So it's great that wages go up, but if wages go up faster than the prices the market can bear, people end up losing money. And why do you think the inflation's so high? Remember the, oh, we have to get $15 an hour in Massachusetts? It's all lies. Because when wages go up, prices go up. And oftentimes, when other factors kick in, prices go up above the gains that you get on wages, and you end up worse off. This is what happened to these workers. 1914. I'm sorry. This is the click I had to get to. Watch the time. Ah, perfect. We'll end up with this point, because then I got to give you the dark side. Oh, and then look at that. Next page. Yeah, looks like we're going to go to Russia. We'll save Russia for next week. All right, let's finish off at this point. Of course, in every economic situation, there are winners and there are losers. While the average working family, yeah, they're making more money, they're getting crushed. Let's be honest. You ever hear the old expression? The rich get richer. When the poor get poorer. Because the government seized control of the factories. Because the government seized control of the agricultural production. They put in set prices. So the up and down of market forces were basically strangled. So the government set the prices so high that people began jumping in and trying to produce as much as possible because the prices were artificially high, higher than what the market would bear. Now, we don't have time to talk about what happened in the 1920s, but I'm sure you've all heard of that wonderful thing called the Great Depression. This rush to make more money is what caused it. Because factory owners said, oh, government's going to pay so much per piece, let's go out and build more buildings. Let's hire more workers. Let's buy more machines. Let's produce and produce and produce. Farmers could get low interest loans. So let's go out and buy more land and make more food. That's great so long as the war was on. But the moment the war ended, and speaking of Papers. I know that some of the people in the class didn't take the exams, so that's the reason why the grades weren't done. As soon as I hear from them and they get their exams done, I will release the grades. All right? Cool. So we're done with exam 3. We're going towards the final, which will be on May 9th, except it will be May 12th for graduating seniors, so that way they fail and they have to stay in class. And papers are due April 26th.